This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Jamie Stillings. He is a photographer. His new book is called The Evolution of Ivanpah Solar. It's about the Ivanpah Solar Facility on the Mojave Desert in California. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
It's a just stunning book of black and white photographs with several essays in the book. And you basically trace the evolution of a solar plant from before a single bit of dirt was turned over until the actual working plant was finished and is in operation. How did you get involved in this project in the first place?
I was finishing up a project called the Bridge at Hoover Dam. And that was a project that came to me during the Great Recession, where on a road trip I encountered a bridge arching its way across the Black Canyon just downstream from Hoover Dam. As that project drew to completion, I was looking for another project to take on, another documentary photography project. I wanted to incorporate my environmental interests and concerns with a long-term fascination photographically of the intersection between nature and human activity. Ivanpah rose to the top as one of several solar energy projects that were on the books and ready to be built, and was interesting because it was scheduled to be the largest project of its type, that is, the largest concentrated solar power plant in the world at that point in time. So given that I had just finished documenting near a dam that had been the largest dam of its day when built in the 30s, the idea of building something that had the potential to be a marker in renewable energy development seemed fascinating to me.
And so what did you do? You approached them and said, hey, I want to document this. Did they then hire you? How does that work?
What you look for is access. And there was a model that I used in the mid-90s. I lived in Rochester, New York at the time, and was interested in the fact that Bausch & Lomb was building their new world headquarters in downtown Rochester when very few corporations were. And in that mid-90s model, I gained corporate support but had editorial documentary independence. And that model interested me. So I approached Bright Source Energy, whose technology was behind the Ivanpah Solar Project. They were interested in giving me access, but less willing or able to give some fiscal support to the project. They connected me up with Bechtel, who is the general contractor for building Ivanpah. And we were unable, among Bright Source, Bechtel, and myself, to arrive at a place where I could have the editorial independence that I required in order to do something that I would term a documentary project. Could I have done a corporate shoot? Yes. But that's not what I was interested in doing. So when it became apparent that I could not have the freedom required to do an on-the-ground project, then I walked away from those talks and I said, what can I do? What I can do is the airspace above Ivanpah is public airspace. I can document this project from the air over a period of 3.5 years, and that will become an interesting project, hopefully. That confidence in the aerial approach or the aerial documentation came out of about 10 flights that I did over the bridge while it was under construction near Hoover Dam. So that component of adding an aesthetic look from the air had been reintegrated into my photographic skill set, let's say, over the previous couple of years. And it seemed like the right way to go for Ivanpah.
It's interesting that you couldn't come to an agreement with them. What did they want? I mean, how did they want to limit you?
Well, Bechtel is, I would say, an anal retentive construction company. They're very, very safety conscious, and they really try, I think, to build their projects correctly. As such, they're control freaks. And that control freaks extends to a couple of areas. One would be the obvious one, revealing technology that might be proprietary to some of the parties involved. And the second is safety. They neither wanted to cause any safety concerns, nor did they want to reveal any safety concerns. So in other words, there are, of course, times when if you have 2,000 workers on site, somebody is not going to be wearing safety glasses when they should be wearing safety glasses, or gloves when they should be wearing gloves. To document that would be to show an OSHA violation. And so their desire was to filter all photography through a filter that would say, is there any violation of safety rules, and is there any revealing of proprietary information in these photographs? Well, when you apply those two filters to it, you take away the documentary component. In addition to that, I think there was a reticence to what I had done a couple of decades earlier in Rochester, which was to have real access to the workers. My feeling was that 2,000 workers were coming from around the United States, the Southwest in particular, during a time of economic stress to have green jobs building this power plant. What kinds of stories could have come out of that, of meeting these people during the day, following them home on the evenings or the weekends to see what their personal stories were? And that would have been a wonderful layering. That wasn't something that Bechtel really understood or could buy into. Their desire to control the ground, so to speak, made it infeasible for me to do what I needed to do. And I walked away from a situation that just didn't seem like I could be a documentary photographer in the way that I needed to be.
Were they then aware that you were doing it from the air or from kind of outside of their control space?
I continued to be in touch with Bright Source Energy throughout the project so that I could get some sense of where construction was and all of that, and had a little bit of contact with Bechtel, but certainly they were aware that I was documenting the project. And with most projects like this, you start off relatively quietly. You're exploring a topic. You don't know where it's going to go. Ideally, you reach a point, a tipping point in the project. And that was for me, I believe, January of 2012, about a little over a year into the project, maybe not quite a year and a half, when I took a few images in the air that just clicked in a certain way. As soon as I took them, I knew it. And as soon as I landed, I said, okay, this is a real project now. This is going to work. This is evolving in a way that will be an interesting body of work over this span of time. I didn't share that work in any kind of public way until an event called PhotoFest, which is a biennial. And in 2012, at the PhotoFest Biennial, I shared that work with a number of reviewers at that event. Got good response to it, and then came back home and said, when do you start sharing a 3.5-year project? What I did was to create a private web gallery for the New York Times Magazine and send that off to the photo department there, Kathy Ryan being the director of photography at the magazine. They had supported the initial trips for the Bridget Hoover Dam project in spring of 2009. So I sent it off to them, really not expecting to hear much back or not much back for a while. Instead, in less than an hour, I got a reply. Please don't show this to anybody. We're very interested in it. Let's talk. So they supported a shoot out to Ivanpah in June of 2012. And following that, published an 8-page photo essay in the magazine. That brought that work to light for the first time.
We're talking to Jamie Stillings about his book of photographs, The Evolution of Ivanpah Solar. So until that time, basically, I mean, it's sort of an interesting, it's interesting for me, for us to imagine your life as a documentary photographer where you take on a documentary, but you're not going to get buy-in from anybody else until you've actually done it for a while. So you're basically taking the risk on yourself.
It's an interesting model, but it's a model that I'm following now. With the bridge work, I took a stand after getting the support for two trips out to the bridge in April and May of 2009 for the New York Times Magazine. I then converted that into a personal documentary project, having made the contacts I needed to establish relationships so that I could continue the project I did as a personal project. And what I discovered was that the expense component of that I was able to recuperate by the end of the project, by the time it was out in the real world. So I took the leap of faith with the Ivanpah project that the same thing would happen. In fact, it did. But at the time that you haven't released work to the world, you still have no idea what the reception is going to be, whether other people find it interesting. But once it moves out into the world, particularly from a publication like the New York Times Magazine, then people start to sit up and take notice. And if they're interested in the topic, if they're interested at all, whether it's within the country or internationally, it will get picked up and it will find new audiences. And that's one of the interesting components of the documentary work that I'm doing.
Let's talk about the site itself. What was the site of this solar plant like before they broke ground?
There are a few ways to describe it for me. One way that I describe it, especially having come out of the Black Canyon surrounding Hoover Dam and kind of the drama of a very rugged canyon environment, was to say it was like a gessoed canvas, that the alluvial slope that came down from Mount Clark and adjacent mountains down to the basin was on the surface somewhat rugged because of the erosion gullies of that alluvial slope. And the scrub brush that is in that area. But once you get up in the air, that starts to take on almost a canvas-like texture. And so what I saw was, in some ways, a blank canvas upon which a site was going to be built. Now, the reality is that area was, and the adjacent area to it, is an area of desert tortoise habitat. It's also an area that has seen a lot of human activity over a course of several centuries. So it's been a traditional area for Native American populations. And since the European populations began to migrate west, it's been an area for mining and continually been inhabited in one way or another within that basin. Right now, Interstate 15, which runs from Las Vegas on its way to Los Angeles, runs through the middle of the basin. There's a golf resort there, the little casino community of Prim, the first opportunity to gamble when you enter Nevada, is right in the basin. There's a gas power plant on the Nevada side and a solar project on the Nevada side as well. So there are a number of ways that the basin has seen marks of human activity, and even though by some ways of viewing it photographically, one might think it's that Ivanpah Solar is in the middle of nowhere. In fact, it's not.
Do you know how that particular site was chosen?
There are a number of ways that sites are chosen. First of all, a prime group of lands that are available or considered available are BLM lands, because they're leasable from the federal government. They're leasable for energy projects, mining projects, etc. Companies that are looking to build renewable energy plants are looking for transmission lines and the way to move that energy to the markets that want to make power purchase agreements with them. So in the case of California, they have renewable energy mandates that they're trying to meet. And so the utility companies for the state are looking to make power purchase agreements with renewable energy projects. So access to transmission lines. And then, in general, areas that have seen some human activity are preferable over things that are in the middle of nowhere. And so, in spite of the fact that there are always environmental issues concerning the siting of projects, the desire is to find a balance between the infrastructural needs of a project and places that have already seen some degree of human impact.
You were doing this work over the course of the several years that the plant was being built. How often did you go there, and how did you choose when you went there?
I flew a total of 19 times over nearly 4 years by the time I finished, the last flight being over the project with Bruce Barcott in September of 2014.
Bruce Barcott being the author of the wonderful essay in this book, and also the author of a terrific book called Weed the People that we featured on this show earlier this year. He's a great writer.
Thank you. I think he is too. I had a basic target of every 3 months, feeling that that would in general be about the right amount of time to see a change in construction, in how things were moving forward. You would have enough of a visual change from the air in particular. But there were things that would make that time extend out. It might be scheduling issues on my side, or it might be perceiving that there were delays or things that weren't going to show a significant enough change in the project to warrant a trip out, because each time that required me flying out to Las Vegas, staying there for a day or two, and chartering a helicopter out of the North Las Vegas airport to come down and fly over the site. That would be early or late. It would be pre-dawn through the early light of sunrise, or it would be late afternoon to dusk. And of course, we'd have things like atmospheric conditions, if it was too hazy, or occasionally thunderstorms, if it were that time of year, things that might also impede my ability to get the kind of photographic documentation that I wanted.
Why do you only photograph early and late in the day?
There are a number of reasons, but the dominant one for me is the desert really reveals its texture when the light is very oblique to the landscape. That ability to reveal texture, both of the natural lines that are there because of erosion and the geology of that area, and the marks of humans that may be ATV tracks or maybe old gravel quarries or mine sites, all of those get revealed when the light is very oblique. And to me, it's a much more interesting and compelling time to photograph. As the sun comes up and is high above, you lose that textural component. And for me anyway, it loses the visual interest that I would prefer to see and try to interpret photographically.
We're talking to photographer Jamie Stillings about his book, The Evolution of Ivanpah Solar. What was it like to see the plant coming from basically from nothing to this final plant, and the lines being drawn in the ground, these towers being built, these solar mirrors like little umbrellas all over the ground? It's a quite beautiful thing for us to behold. What was it like to see it coming together?
Well, I think similar to other projects I've looked at photographically, the tension and in some ways excitement that exists between the natural organic lines like the gullies, the erosion gullies that come down, or the small little hill or mountain that protrudes to the eastern side of the project, those become very visually interesting. And as lines are drawn around to define the project, and as the lines and then the structure was built to create a renewable energy project, I found that the geometry of that precision and the organic quality apparent randomness of the heliostat installation, the mirror installation, to be fascinating. So for me, there was always a component of tension, let's say, between the transformation or the marking of the natural landscape with the formal structure that was being applied in order to create a renewable energy plant. But visually, it's extremely compelling to watch. Obviously, in documenting a project such as this, each person who looks ultimately at the photographs brings to those photographs their own particular set of environmental or political perspectives, and are going to interpret or respond to those photographs differently.
It's interesting because there's a couple of essays in the book, a foreword by Robert Redford, the essay by Bruce Barcott, and also an introduction by Anne Wilkes Tucker, in which she talks about, she compares your work to some of the early days of photography that sort of glorified the new industrial world that was America and the Ford plant. And I mean, when you see those pictures, when you go into the history of photography, you can kind of imagine the incredible beauty that people saw before they understood the kind of destruction that was involved in industrialism. And you know, I know, everybody knows the kind of destruction that's involved in the crazy system that grew out of that, that grew out of those early car plants and factories of all kinds. And here you are documenting something which is beautiful in some of the same ways, and perhaps not destructive in some of the ways that those old ones were. Were you thinking about that as you were working?
I think it's important to understand that any action we take as human beings, virtually any action, has pluses and minuses attached to it. And the sooner we understand that, the better off we are. We have the capacity to weigh the pluses and minuses of what we do. So in that sense, a renewable energy plant like a solar plant, such as Ivanpah, is different and distinct from, say, open pit coal mining. But it also is a choice that we're making about utilization of land and resources. And whenever we make a decision like that, we should not make it lightly. We should realize that there is a positive component, in this case, the creation of renewable energy over a period of decades, that has the ability to reduce our carbon footprint, reduce our use of fossil fuels for electricity generation. But at the same time, it means the relocation of the desert tortoise in that area. And it means that there's a certain amount of avian mortality attached to that. And all of that needs to be put in perspective with the other actions that we as human beings are making on this land.
There was a holding pen that you also documented of these desert tortoises, and Bruce Barcott wrote about them. And it seems like the most biologically sensitive industrial plant of all time when you read about it.
There's a lot of irony and interest when you really start to look at a plant like Ivanpah. And one thing that's important to note is that I'm documenting something that's happening. And while you might look at the photographs and interpret them a certain way, somebody else will look at them differently. Somebody will look at them positively, other people look at them negatively. And I very clearly have seen that over the course of the last 5 years. In the case of the desert tortoise, they thought that a few dozen desert tortoises lived in that area. When they actually went to clear the area of desert tortoises before construction began, they discovered, I think it was about 117 adults and juveniles. Those were all carefully relocated by biologists. They were tagged, identified. The juveniles were brought into a juvenile holding area, individual areas for each juvenile to be, to have their own home. They were all fed, adults and juveniles, the standard food that desert tortoises would get and the amount of moisture that they would get. They began then a very long-term, and it continues, study of the desert tortoise, which has cost well over $20 million to date and will cost upwards to $50 million by the time the project has closed down. They allocated additional lands, dedicated lands, adjacent lands to the desert tortoise. And the adults, as they were released in the spring after this collection, each one of them has a little radio tag on them. And I believe it's twice a year that biologists go out and find each tortoise to see that they're okay and to test them for their health. And so that is an ongoing study that is revealing actually a lot about the habits of the desert tortoise and ultimately will provide a lot of research data to understanding that species. One of the interesting things that happened was because the adult females felt they were in a safe place, they apparently can hold eggs for a long time, and drop eggs several years after they were in fact fertilized. So come the spring, many females dropped eggs. So in addition to having this crop of juvenile tortoises that they had collected when they cleared the site, they now had a new group of hatchlings that needed to be protected until I believe they needed to be 12 centimeters in length before they could be released. So they still are ongoing, this ongoing care, the nursery for the desert tortoise continues. And as they are released, they have a radio tag put on them and again are being tracked. So there's this duality that the desert tortoises represent. So on the one hand, we took away desert tortoise terrain in the creation of this renewable energy site. On the other hand, the care and the research of the desert tortoise will ultimately probably contribute greatly to our understanding of the species and perhaps to future preservation of the species down the line.
Well, I mean, the idea that an industrial installation would lead to a proliferation of desert tortoise young, that every single one of them would be saved, it's not a huge area. I mean, you can take pictures of it and it looks sort of vast, but I've sort of been doing the math about this project, and you could fit 7 of them inside Santa Fe city limits. You know, it's 5.5 square miles, and the Mojave Desert is 47,000 square miles. So it's a tiny little bit of the desert, and the tortoises are presumably hanging out with their cousins 2 miles down the road.
They are. Certainly not the entire Mojave Desert is habitat for desert tortoise. But this brings up for me a really important point. As I have watched this issue, I have begun to listen to, understand, and in many ways wrestle with the difference between what I call local picture issues and big picture issues. So local picture issues, the way I would define them, are usually environmentalists and conservationists who are looking at the specifics of a local piece of land or geography and are trying to protect that, preserve that. So they are looking to use legal means and political means to keep an area from being developed in any way. And there are lots of legitimate reasons for doing that. And the laws that are on the books have helped protect us from clear cutting in the Northwest and strip mining in other areas. There are many legitimate reasons why one could object to some use of land within an area. If you're dealing with environmental issues from a big picture perspective, then you're also saying, yes, we value the Mojave Desert, but what if we used 5% of the Mojave Desert in a very concentrated way to create renewable energy so that we could leave these other basins untouched, leave them preserved, but create the renewable energy in a more compressed way? And in fact, we need to do that because we need to move away from fossil fuels to mitigate the impacts of human activity and reduce global warming. If in fact this area rises 2 degrees Celsius over the next few decades, this might not be desert tortoise terrain anymore because of that temperature rise. And so therefore, the tension between the local picture environmental movement and the big picture environmental movement is significant and very, very challenging right now.
And when you talk about 117 desert tortoises, and when you talk about the cumulative effect of coal-fired power on untold numbers of species, not only the ones living in the habitat where the coal plant is, but hundreds and thousands of miles away, really covering the whole globe. I mean, that's the big picture.
One of the studies I looked at along the way tried to make a comparison between fossil fuel power generation and renewable energy power generation as it related to avian mortality or bird deaths. We often take a look and we think about, say, bird deaths by wind turbines, for instance. And again, bird deaths from wind turbines are a local event. So they impact birds in that site and specific species of birds in that site. But let's step back and look at that differently. We kill between 500 million and a billion birds a year just by hitting windows of buildings and houses.
And it's 1 to 4 billion get eaten by cats.
By cats, both domesticated and feral cats. So we have a huge impact that we haven't talked about pesticides. We haven't talked about power lines. We haven't talked about vehicles moving on roads. All of those that impact birds. The study that I looked at came to the conclusion that per gigawatt hour of electricity produced, that fossil fuels were 17 times more deadly to bird populations than was wind power. And at the time, they did not have statistics for concentrated solar. I still don't know that they have them together. But the statistics for concentrated solar are probably closer to wind by a long shot, probably very, very close to wind than they are to fossil fuels. So the problem is that if a bird dies from a wind turbine and there's somebody monitoring that, they will find that bird below the wind turbine. If a bird falls into a storage pond at a gas or an oil well, they may or may not be discovered or counted. If they die because of respiratory disease from acid or sulfur dioxide in the air, they may never be counted as anything because where they die or how they die would never be recorded. So it's a very complex issue. And one of the things that I'm trying to do with my work is to get people to engage in conversation and to get them to engage in a more complex way of understanding that to find solutions, to move forward in a constructive and ultimately a way that can see success for us as a species, we need to be able to understand our impact and the nature of our impact and then make constructive, proactive decisions. And to not do anything, to freeze and say we can't change anything is an inappropriate action. To not be aware of our actions, whether they involve consumerism or the use of fossil fuels or the creation of renewable energy, without properly thinking about that, that's also a mistake.
Do you think environmentalists are harder on environmentally conscious power plants than they are on all the other dirty ones?
I don't know whether I can apply the word harder, because that probably implies a higher level of understanding the wide range of actions. But I will tell you that there's a real tension and some real limitations in the ability to communicate among various components of, I'll say, concerned citizens, whether we're calling them conservationists or we're calling them environmentalists. They are coming at this from different perspectives. And yes, I have seen areas, I've seen proposed plants within designated solar energy zones. Those are zones designated by the government in collaboration with environmental groups and the renewable energy industry as prime zones to create renewable energy. Areas that are near highways, that are near transmission lines, that have already seen human impact. I have seen the pushback by local picture environmentalists to be every bit as fierce within those solar energy zones as within other places. And ultimately, we all are using fossil fuel. We all are using energy. We're all, in that sense, hypocrites. There are none of us that have really a carbon neutral footprint. Where does our sweater come from? Where do our shoes come from? How are we moving from one place to another? We want to go to that store and have the lights on and have the heat be on. We want to have 24/7 electricity at home and at work. So we're all part of a consumer-based society. So therefore, there is a bitter irony to me when I see the inability of people to think critically and constructively about how we have to move forward. So is there pushback against coal-fired power plants? Absolutely. Is there pushback against oil and gas in certain areas of the country? Absolutely. Is there a strong pushback against a lot of renewable energy projects? I would say every bit as energetically as any other thing I've ever seen. And it continues to be an area of fascination to me. There's one area in particular that relates to the Ivanpah project and to another project that is going to come online very soon. Ivanpah Solar, the power purchase agreement for it when it was being designed and before it was built, was to create power during the day. And the technology at Ivanpah is to use the heliostats or mirrors pointed at the top of the towers to superheat water to create steam to drive steam turbines. When you drive steam turbines, that technology is identical to a coal, gas, oil, geothermal power plant, nuclear power plant. All of those are nothing more than giant tea kettles. They're boiling water to create steam to drive steam turbines. The new plant that is coming online and will probably be announced that it's online in January is called Crescent Dunes. It's a project by a company called Solar Reserve. And that uses molten salt technology to collect the thermal heat of the sun and to store that. So with a project like Ivanpah, which will in my mind, probably not be built again because it doesn't have storage. It only produces power during the day, which is very similar in its arc to what a photovoltaic power plant, the solar panels that we have on our roofs and the big solar plants that are out around the country. They collect electricity from the sun during the day. When the sun goes down, they're done. Crescent Dunes has 70 million pounds of molten salt, and cold salt, in quotes, is 540 degrees Fahrenheit. Hot salt is 1,050 degrees Fahrenheit. So what can happen then is you can collect the thermal energy of the sun during the day. In the case of Crescent Dunes, it's 110 megawatt capacity. They can collect that thermal energy. But let's say the power plant says we only need 30 megawatts right now. So they collect that by heating that salt, that 70 million pounds of salt up and storing it in a tank that only loses 0.5 degree Fahrenheit per day. The sun goes down, people come home from work, they turn their air conditioners on, and the power utility says, give us 110 megawatts. That plant will now be delivering that power into the evening because they've collected it during the day but disconnected the collection of thermal energy from the production of that electricity. So what you've done is you collect the thermal heat of the sun through the salt, and then that transfer of the heat energy to water comes at the point that you choose.
Which is really amazing and really important, because something that we don't even think about. We turn on our dryers whenever we want to. We turn on the swamp coolers or the air conditioners whenever we want to. But how much energy and in what loads it's produced and how variable that is something we don't even think about.
We don't think about it, but utility companies are basically delivering power on demand all of the time, and they are balancing the grid all of the time. To return to the notion of concentrated solar power, that plant that will open up next month that is like apples and oranges to the Ivanpah plant. They're very related, but they're each distinct. They're both tower projects, but one has storage, one does not. Those are likely to be the last two tower projects built in the United States, possibly for a decade. Meanwhile, around the world, the understanding of the specific contribution of concentrated solar power, we will see power plants in South Africa, in the Atacama Desert in Chile, in India, in China, in the Middle East. We will see those power plants built because of the understanding of how they can contribute, along with photovoltaic and wind power, to the complex creation of a 24-hour energy cycle.
Why do you say these are the last tower plants that will likely be built in the United States for a decade?
I think there are three components that contribute to that, probably more. One is that, unlike photovoltaic power plants, there are relatively few of these that have been built. We're all familiar with the dramatic drop in price of photovoltaic panels within the last few years, so that we're now looking at a cost factor of 10 to 20% of what they were just a few years ago. So that makes photovoltaic much more economically viable than it was when a project like Ivanpah or Crescent Dunes were just on the drawing table. So right now, concentrated solar power is more expensive than photovoltaic and more expensive than wind right now. The second thing is that there's been a tremendous amount of pushback The pushback being that there is a visual and a literal impact, predominantly to birds, with projects like this. That threat or that impact has been exaggerated again by local picture environmental groups, and there's been a lot of work to mitigate that. The most challenging, we all know that that air travel is much safer than automobile travel, for instance. Tens of thousands of people are killed every year on the roads and only a few hundred in the air, but we tend to have more fear of that which we see on TV. In a similar
plane
way,
crashes are dramatic.
They're dramatic.
And I was thinking about that with the birds. I mean, we, in exchange for driving cars, are willing to lose tens of thousands of people to auto fatalities per year. It seems like, for better or worse, you kind of have to know that that's the same thing when you build a clean power plant.
There's always an environmental impact, and there's an environmental impact for everything that we do. The thing that's dramatic about tower projects is that there are multiple ways that birds can die on a site. One of those is by hitting mirrors or other structures, and one of them is by flying in a very narrow area that's about 50 or 100 meter radius around the tower. And in that area, when an object flies through that area, the concentrated solar energy will in fact heat that object up. And if that object's a bird, it will heat that bird up to the point that it might burst into flames. Well, renewable energy companies don't want that to happen. None of us want that to happen. But if that ends up being a few hundred birds a year, and you put that in the context of the hundreds of millions and billions of birds that we kill by other causes for what we do as human beings, then is it more dramatic and is it horrible? Yes. Do I want to see a single bird die from any means? No. But let's keep it in perspective and to try to give it some understanding of what that means.
I mean, I think another piece of that perspective is the water use of Ivanpah and of similar solar plants, which is very, very low per megawatt compared to a coal plant or any of these other fossil fuel-based plants that we've been talking about.
There's a huge difference. In the case of photovoltaic and wind, there's virtually no water being used. So there are projects like Mount Signal, which is in the southern Imperial Valley right along the Mexico border near Calexico, where you're taking alfalfa fields that are very, very water-intensive crops. Alfalfa fields that were often and are often a crop that's exported to places like Japan and China for Kobe beef and cattle in other countries. That, in fact, is exporting a water resource from California to another country when you're taking a crop and exporting it like that. Put in photovoltaic power plants right on the edge of that border there, and you're retiring some of those alfalfa fields, and you're going to virtually zero water use. It's also being done in a way that if a few decades from now that land needed to go back to agriculture, that it can. The disruption of the land on that particular project is nominal. The poles that are supporting the photovoltaic panels are drilled into the ground, and so you're not scraping that topsoil off. So there are examples like that where you're seeing going from a very high water use scenario down to virtually nothing. In the case of Ivanpah, when I spoke to them in September of 2014, and they were 9 months into a year of initial power generation, their allocation was 100 acre feet for that project. And at the end of September, they had used less than 20 acre feet for the year. So the actuality of the concentrated solar projects are that they seem to be overall quite low water use as well.
We're talking to photographer Jamie Stillings. Do you know whether in the area where these mirrors are that reflect light to the tower and boil the water, underneath, in that vicinity, are there still any kind of wildlife living? Are they coexisting inside the plant?
They are discouraging animal activity within the plant, but it obviously happens. So there are rodents that are within there and nesting and that type of thing. The challenge, of course, with wildlife is that they can have an impact on the physical infrastructure of the plant. So if you have hundreds of miles of cabling running through an area, if rodents decide to nibble on cabling and sever it, then you're creating infrastructure issues for the plant. There are scenarios where, for instance, red foxes nested, created a burrow, what I can't remember the right term for that, within the plant, and they basically have to cordon that area off because of the protection afforded to the fox. And so then you're creating this little fox sanctuary within the plant, and that type of thing definitely exists.
What is the water used for that they do use? I mean, there's water inside that's boiled to make electricity, but that's a closed loop system. It's cooled and then reheated and cooled and reheated. What else do they use water for?
So you're correct that the dominant use is first and foremost the circulatory system of the concentrated solar power plant. Water that's superheated, turned into steam, recondensed back through an air cooling system and brought back into the loop. That's highly purified water, and they use it as much as and for as long as they can. The other dominant use at the plant is cleaning mirrors, because as mirrors get dirty over time, their efficiency decreases. So you really, if you have 173,000 heliostats spread among three different fields, you're going to require an ongoing mirror washing service to keep those clean. And that's the dominant other use. And they, of course, are working on ways to minimize their water use in the cleaning function for that.
I know you were mostly in the air taking photographs from above in this book, but I can't help but wondering, now that the plant is up and running, what is it like on the ground? Is it very quiet?
The plant itself is very, very quiet. There is a stillness to it. You're going to hear some movement as mirrors, each of these mirrors are heliostats, they're pairs of mirrors actually, continually rearticulate themselves to form the angle of reflection between the sun and the top of their respective towers. You can hear some other noises around the power block, the center of each of these. I would say realistically that the dominant thing that you notice is that the towers are quite bright. And if there's one thing that's a bit of a challenge along the way, it's that you're concentrating a lot of electricity or a lot of thermal energy, light energy to the top of these towers. So as you're going down Interstate 15, you definitely see that, you notice that. And like reflection off of a big glass building, when you get in the reflection from a sun, you need to exercise the same type of precautions that you would for that type of scenario.
What are your hopes for this book?
My hopes for the book are to open up communication and understanding. It's one part informative. I want people to learn about this particular technology because it is one plant to look at. I want them to consider the pluses and minuses of building renewable energy. And in a bigger sense, I want to begin a long-term look at the development of renewable energy. It's one positive, proactive way that we as human beings are trying to move away from fossil fuels and to utilizing the energy of the current sun, as Tom Hartman used the term. Current sunlight is very different than using the concentrated sunlight of fossil fuels from millions, hundreds of millions of years ago. Right. So in that sense, I'm wanting to initiate a conversation with people that will go on for many, many years, I hope, where I look at the development of renewable energy both in the United States and around the world and can help share that through a variety of venues over time that will help people track that along with me.
Jamie Stillings is a photographer. His new book is The Evolution of Ivanpah Solar. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Jamie Stillings' documentary work can be found on the web at jamiestillingsprojects.com, J-A-M-E-Y, Stillings. And you can also find his work at Photo Eye Bookstore and Gallery at 376 Garcia Street right here in Santa Fe, and also on the web at photoeye.com. Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.